Good morning, everybody. Thank you all for coming to this event. This is, for those of you who didn't know, sponsored by the Manhattan Institute, which is dedicated to pragmatic solutions to urban problems. And what we're going to talk about today, and hopefully explore solutions to, is the issue of reconnecting a certain segment of disadvantaged men to the workforce in a way which has not been the case for especially about the past three decades. The Manhattan Institute has been instrumental in forging the reform of welfare legislation, starting in terms of actual policy in 1996. And by all measures, this has been a success. It certainly hasn't been a magic bullet, but we are seeing that most of the women who have been brought into these programs are working, and childhood poverty among, for example, African American children is going down and has gone down especially quickly since 1996 when these programs were instituted. However, it can be said that we've only done half the job in initiating these policies because welfare reform has focused necessarily, in particular, on women. There are also men who have had similar problems based on the way legislation for welfare was administered starting in about 1966. We are faced with a problem where a very large number of disadvantaged men, particularly black and brown men, are disconnected from the workforce regardless of the state of the economy and with only a fitful relationship to the availability of low-skill work. The question is what to do about it. Importantly, the issue is not to just talk about how bad it is or to condemn anyone as an individual. The issue is what to do about it in terms of policy. And so this issue seems to be cresting somewhat in public consciousness, and that's what this conference is about. There are going to be three panels, and we're going to kick off with the first one. The first one is an overview panel on the issues, and we have a wonderful assemblage of panelists for this particular segment. And the panelists are Ronald Mincy, who is professor of social policy and social work at Columbia University. And we also have Hillard Pouncey, who is visiting professor at the Woodrow Wilson School of Public Policy at Princeton, who's a specialist on anti-poverty legislation as well as work on bringing ex-offenders back into the workforce. And we have Lawrence Mead, who is in the political science department at New York University and is also a specialist on anti-poverty legislation and welfare reform, and the Manhattan Institute's own Abigail Thernstrom, who is the author of Whose Votes Count, and with her husband Stephen Thernstrom, America in Black and White, and more recently, No Excuses. There's an important book to read, which can be thought of as almost the souvenir booklet of this conference in terms of actually engaging with these issues on the printed page. That book is Black Males Left Behind, and it's an anthology of papers on this particular issue and what can be done about it. Professor Mincy is the editor of that book. With that, I think we should begin, and the first panelist to speak will be Professor Mincy. Professor Mincy.
Good morning. It's certainly my privilege to be here to continue to participate in this conversation. I have essentially two points that I'd like to make, and they in a way build on some comments that will be made later. However, I've been looking at the issue of African-American men and boys for now about three decades. We have in this country been circling and cycling around the challenges of African-American men, less educated African-American men, and mainstreaming them for at least three decades. In 1987, there was a book that was published called Young Black Men, An Endangered Species. And this was the last time I remember a study provoking a major conversation. There were state and local commissions in cities around the country trying to address this issue. I want to suggest several things that I learned coming out of that experience. In order to plant some seeds for thinking about what we should be doing in the current environment. In the first place, we have seen in the last 15 years a number of demonstration projects that are targeted at disadvantaged youth, out-of-school youth, high school dropouts, and the like. Often, these programs receive boosts in funding and boosts in public interest because they are provoked by a spate of information about what is occurring adversely with respect to African American men. The most recent time that this occurred was the genesis of the Youth Opportunity Grant Program, which was a spatially targeted youth to adult transition program for all young people who resided in 20% poverty areas, though the research that motivated the Youth Opportunity Grant Program was focused on inner cities. The Youth Opportunity Grant Program ended up being a program that was focused, again, at young people who lived in poor neighborhoods in highly concentrated urban areas as well as in rural areas. What this and a number of other programs like this suggest is that often news about the adverse outcomes of young, less educated African American men is a catalyst behind a series of legislative programs, nonprofit initiatives targeted at young people more generally. Sometimes they are called disconnected youth, with the idea that they are young people who are not attached to firmly attached to families. They are high school dropouts and the like. Sometimes they are targeted at, again, youth who are dropouts, but they are rarely, we rarely have the capacity to target initiatives at African American males or at disadvantaged males specifically. On the other hand, when these programs are evaluated to the extent that they are, they often show that initiatives targeting disadvantaged youth end up having decent results for girls. However, their consequences for boys and young males are disappointing. This has been the case with a major evaluation of the Job Training Partnership Act, which was the major employment program targeting disadvantaged workers. The youth programs were evaluated in the late 1980s and concluded that the results for young women were cost effective in terms of increasing their employment rates, in terms of increasing their earnings, but the impacts of JTPA programs for young males were not only not statistically significant, but some of them actually did worse than those who were not enrolled in these programs. A second case recently in which this occurred is the QUAP program. This was also a youth development program targeted initially at the children of welfare recipients. And the objective of the program was to focus on a vulnerable population of young people to provide for them a set of concentrated supports, including mentoring, tutoring, and the like, and to see if by focusing on a vulnerable population before they showed signs of trouble, we could increase graduation rates, college enrollment rates, and the like. Again, we got the set of results that these programs work well for girls, but they work poorly for boys. The most recent information along these lines is the Moving to Opportunity program. This was a major demonstration in Chicago where resources were targeted at single mothers who lived in high poverty areas in the city of Chicago. And the idea was to provide these women with an opportunity and children to move to lower poverty areas where there were more substantial labor markets, better schools, safer environments. And again, we get the set of results that moms transitioned to employment, the girls found new friends, connected with new people in the community and the school and so on. And the results for girls in terms of teenage pregnancy rates, high school graduation rates, and the like are pretty good. The boys, on the other hand, tended to return to their own neighborhood, to their old neighborhoods, their old environments, and as a result, their results for high school graduation, college enrollment, crime, and the like are disappointing. So we now, with the single exception in my reading of the Career Academies program, this is the only, Career Academies was a school to work kind of initiative that was focused on young people who are likely to be high school dropouts. It created a high school environment that was focused on a particular career track and then taught reading, writing, and the like in the context of that career orientation. This was the unique program that I'm aware of that tended to show better results for males than for females. So we have then, over the last 15 years, a few programs targeted at disadvantaged young people who are making the transition from youth to adulthood, often provoked by negative news about what's happening with respect to African-American males, and the results show that the programs work for boys, for women or young girls, and they do not work for boys. I think this is creating an important signal as we go into the next round of programming, and to be sure, there will be one around how to resolve the challenges that many young people are experiencing, and especially the challenges that are being experienced by African-American males. And that is that we have to focus on the role in programming of gender in creating these disadvantages. We have to ask, why is it that males, or how do males learn differently in schools than do young women? What is it about the ability of young males to focus, to sit still, to focus on the academic process? At what periods of time do they need a break from the academic enterprise, and do they need recreation periods that are longer, that are experienced more frequently than girls do? And can we create academic environments that are peculiarly focused on the learning styles of males so that we can achieve more success at young people, and males in particular, in terms of making the school to work, the youth to adult transition? When we explored, face it, young people, African Americans in particular, live in highly segregated environments. They go to schools which are predominantly Black and Puerto Rican in the first place. However, when in the late 1980s we tried to create single gender schools, we ran into huge civil liberties challenges. Why do you need to create special educational environments for Black boys? And when you do so, do you advantage them with respect to girls? My own view is that we short-circuited efforts at creating single-gender schools, just as one example, and in the process, we yielded the kind of challenges that we have today, where we have high school graduation rates for African-American males in New York City hovering about a third, declining employment rates, and the other things that we are aware of from these recent studies. The second point that I would like to make is we have to think especially then about the role of race and gender and have the courage to carry that thinking through into the kinds of programming that we do, and that's going to represent a huge challenge. The other part of the puzzle, though, is when we create a set of tools, when we go out and do legislation that creates youth development programs or high school dropout programs or whatever, or deal with ex-offender programs, we create certain tools for working with this population. What about the craftsmen? That is, who is it that is able to access the tools, the funding that is available in order to serve these young men? So the other side of the problem is that programs that tend to focus on African-American males who basically live in a very highly segregated environment tend not to have the capacity to garner the resources to focus the tools that are available at this population. Again, in my 20 years of working in this area, the infrastructure
of programs that work with young African-American males is in fundamental disarray. And one of the reasons for that is that we have been very episodic in our interest in this population. So that when we create a set of programs, when we create a set of legislation focusing on African-American males, resources are available. Within a few years, those resources are drawn away. And the organizations that had built up some expertise and begun to learn some lessons about how to serve these populations go away with the decline in funding. I think this has a lot to do with the disappointing results with respect to African-American males and a different set of outcomes with respect to women, because as John suggested in his opening comments, we have been pursuing programming around teenage pregnancy prevention and welfare reform for 40 years. Our initial efforts around welfare reform that were so successful in 1996 are really the culmination of a 40-year effort, beginning in 1962 and then turning from welfare to work in 1967, that we have pursued using different strategies but consistently for a 40-year period. That means that we try things, we learn certain things, we fail at certain things, we jettison approaches, but the organizations that have been serving young women and girls have had the capacity over a period of 40 years to perfect their art, and ultimately we had the convergence of learning from programming on the one hand and an extraordinary economy on the other, and then a policy that was designed to put women to work. In the absence of such consistent funding, we will never build the capacity that we need among programs that serve young African-American males to deliver the same kinds of results. So in closing, we have to pay attention to two sorts of things. One, what peculiarly is the role of race and gender? And will we have the courage not only to identify how race and gender create adverse outcomes for young people, but can we push through that race and gender understanding into the kinds of programming that we do? And secondly, once we get the theory right and can talk about the tools, will we then be able to provide the infrastructure and support the building of the infrastructure among programs that work with these young people so that those who know how to do the job have the capacity to compete in the public arena for funding and deliver the services that are needed? I hope we'll have an opportunity to exchange about this, but I see that my time is being yanked. Thank you.
I think there are two separate conversations or dynamics controlling our conversations about mainstreaming. I think one conversation is within the broader public, and if you're attentive, you see it. The other one, I think, is within the black community, and it's a more difficult conversation to hear. My view is that both conversations have the capacity to reinforce barriers to mainstreaming, or they can help us overcome barriers to mainstreaming. And my second view is that we need both these conversations. They feed off each other, and they go in two very different directions. They can either together function to reinforce barriers, or together, I think, they can operate to help us overcome barriers. And what I want to focus on is how would you get us out of phase one, where you get conversations that increase barriers, reinforce them, and create incentives and structures for conversations that help us overcome these barriers. Now, in the broader public, an example of conversations and dynamics that create barriers to mainstreaming came up, I think, beginning about the last quarter century, and it's essentially a conversation that says, well, if less well-educated men in general and young black males specifically are causing trouble, well, let's lock them up. And we're very good at these things. And so for the last quarter century, we've created structures and incentives for politicians and policymakers alike to devise ways to operate on a goal of addressing the issues of crime and its connection to less educated men. And in fact, we've done such a good job of it that in the book, Black Males Left Behind, we talk about recent work done by Bruce Western at Princeton, who shows that we got so good at increasing incarceration and addressing the problems of crime that when we reduced levels of crime in the 1990s, throughout that decade, we also increased incarceration. Now, think about that. You'd think the main goal of locking people up would be to stop crime. Well, we achieved the goal. We reduced crime. Crime started being lower. So wouldn't you think then that you would reduce levels of incarceration? And in fact, the opposite happened. Now, when I asked Bruce, how so? Why so? He said, well, what we did is we took youngsters who had committed a crime at time one, say in the 80s, and we'd give them a certain amount of jail time or a certain number of them would be put into a diversion program. But as we rolled into the 90s, what we were more likely to do with such a youngster is we double the chances of a youngster in the 1990s going to jail. And if they did go to jail, their chances of staying in jail longer increased. And so the result of that was structures and incentives that led to an ability of our society to incarcerate these young men so effectively that when the need to incarcerate them, crime rates went down, we kept doing it. So the question is there another way to think about this? Is there another conversation we might have about less well-educated men? And the answer is obvious. That's why we're here. The answer is, well, to think about mainstreaming. But the key is, what happens if you get what you want? What does mainstreaming mean? Now, using the parallel of the welfare conversation, the goal often on in the period we talked about welfare reform was self-sufficiency. Well, when we actually, in the minds of most of us, got what we wanted out of welfare reform, self-sufficiency in practical terms really meant this, that young mothers who required public assistance were pushed off the welfare rolls into lives of self-sufficiency. They were pushed into a situation that, or let's call it a process, in which they became eligible for a number of supports, the earned income tax credit, child care benefits, food stamps, and so forth. So that when we really looked at it and we achieved the goal of self-sufficiency for welfare moms, the reality of self-sufficiency was something less than self-sufficiency. It was a process, it was a series of supports. But politically, we could gain help for welfare moms in the name of self-sufficiency with the practicality of important supports. Well, how are we to make that kind of anecdote relevant to the case of less well-educated men? Well, we're here talking about mainstreaming. And the key is to put meaning behind the idea of mainstreaming. And if we remember the lessons of welfare reform, what we might want to think about when we say mainstreaming is some sort of a minimal standard. Michael Katz calls this minimum standards of citizenship. He argues that when we talk about public policy, we do one thing for citizens and other things for our non-citizens, our immigrants, et cetera. And when we're talking about the undeserving poor, young black men, for example, we are, in the hidden language of public policy, talking about whether these are young citizens or not. Well, if we argue that mainstreaming may simply mean that we want young men from this point on to accept and enter the world of work in cases where they become young fathers without benefit of marriage, honor their obligations to their children, oh, and lay off the crime. Let's not do crime. Well, if we could strike a public contract so that on one side of the ledger, young men increasingly find these terms of living in America acceptable, then the lessons of welfare reform would suggest that we then create a new structure, a new set of incentives for our political leaders and public policymakers to, in effect, compete with each other to honor their side of that contract. Now, the lessons of welfare reform is that it took some period of time, Ron says 40 years, but eventually we got there. In the book, what we argue for is, how do we create that same kind of conversation, create those same set of incentives for politicians to, in effect, fuss over how do we mainstream young men if we understand mainstreaming to be getting people in a process so that for those who choose to be responsible fathers, the child support system gets into dialogue with them. For those who choose to avoid a life of crime, the options of becoming employed are stronger for them. In a quick digression, there's a study, and I suspect everyone in this room knows it. I'm just going to repeat it very briefly to show how difficult we're talking, how difficult these issues are. Diva Pager took some youngsters from clubs like this, I think in her specific, she took some Columbia undergraduates and gave them pieces of paper that said, for the white ones and for black ones, that's how she divided her sample, I'm a youngster without any education, I haven't finished high school, but I haven't been in jail. And for another set, she said, I have been in jail, I have a criminal record. She sent them out to get jobs in the arena we're talking about. Well, in most cases, none of them got, in most cases, they didn't get a call back. But in the cases where they did, her observation was that young black males who said, I don't have a criminal record, were less likely to get a callback than young white males, similarly, otherwise similar, who said they did have a criminal record. And that was the headline in the papers. Oh, it's so rough. Well, I talked to her about it, and it struck me that, wait a second, youngsters coming out of Columbia are the ideal in today's labor force. They have every skill imaginable. And yet the Kafka-like sense of the thing was, you send that youngster, they must look like Columbia grads, right? We've seen them in this club here. They seem very presentable. And yet, visibly looking at the employer in the eye, the employer didn't see him and see if, you know, this is the perfect worker. So something really has happened here. And so when we talk about barriers to mainstreaming, that's the level of the problem. Now, again, our only point today is to simply say, how do we structure politics? How do we create incentives for politicians and policymakers to, in effect, compete with each other to do some of the minimal things that we think mainstreaming should be? Okay, well, that's one half the conversation. Now, the other half of the conversation is what's going on in the black community. And again, I'm going to appeal to a cartoon of this. I would think everyone in this room knows who Bill Cosby is, and I would dare guess that a fair number of you know who Eric Dyson is. Well, these two gentlemen have been having a public discussion of late about the issues we're talking about, but it's been a toxic discussion. Bill, for his part, says the African-American community should behave more responsibly, and our youngsters should not engage in crime and become mainstream. And that's, and he said it in a certain way, and Dyson took offense to it, and in effect they began a policy conversation, but a very toxic one in which, in effect, one says, I don't like what you've said, and the other says, I don't like what you've said, but the result is a lot of heat, not much movement, not much effectiveness, not much fruitful discussion on what's to be done. And in the book, we try to think of a more, productive way of having a discussion within the black community about these problems. And what came to our mind was the Million Man March. In effect, policy idea. Why don't I get a bunch of people together, maybe in Washington, and say, we ought to mainstream our young people. Seems like a good idea. In fact, in the 1960s, Martin Luther King tried it, and it seemed to have worked. Very good speech. So why wouldn't that work now? Or more accurately, why didn't that work in the 1990s? Well, the answer seems to be that one shot is a woeful answer to a large social problem. Once the marchers leave town, what else happens? Where's the infrastructure? How do you build on that? And so we didn't think about it anymore in the book. We just said, well, it seems to be a situation that leaves the black community bereft of an opportunity to contribute to this conversation. Well, we thought about it. And in a recent study that I wish I had moved further along to hand out because I think it's really interesting, what we did was we looked at some dialogue within the political science community of late. And the short version of this thing goes something like this. The hidden elephant in this room is a theory that John's talked about many, many times called the spatial mismatch hypothesis, which simply means if you remove rich people, if you put poor people and rich people, jobs and people who need jobs in different places, bad things are going to happen. Well, it's a theory, and you know, most people find some parts of it right, but most of us find many parts of it wrong. But in the case of the African-American community, something really interesting has begun to happen. As you've separated better-off blacks and less well-educated, less well-off blacks, to the extent that we can tell, when you suburbanize, when the black community pulls apart along socioeconomic fissures, the chances of the community thinking holistically about its problems begin to decrease. In other words, the Dyson-Cosby debate is symptomatic of a larger dynamic going on within the black community, and this is based on survey evidence.
Professor Pouncey,
2 minutes?
One
minute. I can do this. So when we looked at some data on communities in Philadelphia, what we found is that in cases where that hasn't happened, where well-off African Americans still live within the community, dynamics begin to take place so that you create a capacity for a community to host its own conversation about mainstreaming. What's the evidence? Well, we looked at some voting evidence, and I can tell you about it later. I'm running out of time. And so in sum, 30-second summation, in my view, we need two kinds of conversations. And there's some evidence that both kind are in progress, but there's a lot of evidence that the alternative to those conversations, the toxic versions, are very much underway. But once we have confirmed in our minds what mainstreaming means as some minimal set of standards and behaviors that we expect of our young people, and the black community, for its part, reinforces that and generates its, within itself a capacity to echo and reinforce those conversations, I think there's some hope. Thank you.
Well, it's a real pleasure to be here. This is an important meeting. I have a sense that there is indeed a new wave of interest in the problem of low-income men, and I hope this time it leads to some fundamental policy changes. I'm going to talk mainly about adult men, poor men, and how we might reconnect with them, how society can reconnect, and how they can reconnect. Among poor men in 2004, less than 20% worked full-time in full year, and nearly 60% did not work at all. Now, these men have a lot of problems. This isn't the only one, maybe not the most serious, but it's the one that stands out, and it's the one that I think we can do something about. Non-work is, it seems to me, the main immediate reason why these men are poor. It's also the reason for their problems as husbands and fathers. A man who doesn't work regularly can't satisfy his employer, and he can't satisfy his spouse or his children. So this problem is strategic, and by addressing it, I think we can make some real progress in reconnecting these men. Now, in the past, we've approached this problem in terms of economics. I'm a political scientist like Hillard, and there is a disciplinary struggle going on here. I believe, truly, politics is the master science, and that is the way we need to solve this, and I'll try to say how. The economists approach the work problem in terms of human capital. They'll say that the men we're talking about lack skills, so we should invest more in them. We tend to see them as empty vessels, passive figures into which we have to pour resources. Now, as Ron has pointed out, programs that try to do this, training programs, don't evaluate very well. In fact, they somehow don't get the job done. The same for most education programs serving this population. Another thing we say is that another economic perspective is that there's something wrong with the labor market. There's something wrong with the opportunity structure. Jobs are not available. This was one of the contentions of the mismatch theory that Hillard has spoken about. Evidence for that isn't very good, or we say the jobs don't pay enough, so that's why the men remain poor, even if they work. It turns out their main problem is that they don't work at all, not that they're working at low wages. So we say if they had more and better jobs, then that would solve our problem. Doesn't look that way. The problem has more to do with the fact that these men are not fully engaged in the labor market. Well, what do we do about that? Well, liberals tend to say we've got to somehow spend more money on these people. We have to generate more resources for them, and I've already heard some notes to that effect from the previous speakers. Conservatives say, well, that's the problem. Government's trying to do too much. Government ought to actually withdraw from interfering with the labor market and let men find their own best employment. So it's all about economics, and it's all about doing more versus doing less. That tends to be the debate. Now, welfare reform, to which you've already heard reference, has shown us that this is fundamentally mistaken. In the welfare arena, the way that we solved our problem was we got away from economic thinking. We used to say about the welfare mothers, too, that they lacked human capital or that the labor market was inadequate. And for a lot of the 40 years that we've heard about, much of the reforms that we tried were ways to rejiggle the labor market or change incentives or have some kind of training or investment program. Didn't get anywhere. And then about 20 years ago, we hit on the idea of actually requiring the mothers to work. It turned out that was the answer. If we had programs that seriously required the mothers to work as a condition of aid, then they would in fact go to work. Now, we had to spend some money too, but the crucial thing was authority, was having there be a clear-cut work requirement. And starting about 20 years ago, we began to get positive evaluations for work programs like this, mandatory work programs. And from that point, a snowball started to roll, and it swept right through the welfare system until today we have a totally different system. The key wasn't money. The key was accepting that there had to be a work opportunity, the work obligation. And the effect of that, the positive effects of that, then generated the public commitment to spend more as necessary. So we did, in fact, spend more. We had spent more on child care and wage subsidies and all these supports. But that was acceptable because it was now going to enforce a value which the public deeply believed in, was that there should be a work obligation connected to work to public aid. The public was not upset by the cost of welfare. The studies show clearly the public was upset by the work problem. They wanted the recipients to work alongside the taxpayers. That was their supreme desire about welfare reform. And once they got it, the coffers opened, and money was no object. And that's what we have to do, it seems to me, for the men. Let's look at their problem. It seems to me one way to interpret what's going on is that we, too, have to get away from an economic logic in dealing with them. It's true that they do need some new benefits. We need to perhaps talk about higher minimum wage, higher earned income tax credit. We particularly have to do something about immigration, in my view, unless we can prevent employers from immediately resorting to hiring illegal Mexicans in place of low-skilled Americans. We're not going to get very far. We have to realize that this issue is connected to the immigration battle. But with all that, this is only a small part of the problem. The main problem is that the men we're talking about don't actually face a serious requirement to work on a regular basis. That's what we have to tackle. We have to somehow get a grip on these guys and the way we did on the mothers. We have to somehow say to them, you have to work, and we have to work consistently. And if you do that, we'll help you in 25 ways. If we do that, I'm quite convinced that then education and training programs are going to have much more effect because the men will face a serious requirement to work steadily. Also, this addresses the politics. I mean, there's an assumption in some of the previous comments that the public has to be persuaded to spend money on low-income black men. I think the public's going to be willing to spend money when we show results from serious work programs that require employment and back that up in some way, and you show results from that, and then once again the coffers will open, and there will be a generous public response to the idea of enforcing a value in which we believe, which is the work ethic. So don't ask for money up front. Ask for the authority to obligate these men, and then the money will follow. In a sense, we have to do what Pat Moynihan talked about in the Moynihan Report 40 years ago. We have to put them in the Army. We have to find out some way to put these guys in the Army. Now, the Army isn't available any longer. It's a volunteer force. We have to find a way to substitute for the Army. Well, how might you do that? How do you find an authority structure that will require these guys to work? Unfortunately, we don't have a benefit system like the welfare system with the same breadth and strength that that system offered for the mothers. It seems that we have to resort primarily to two other structures, institutions which already deal with low-income men. One of them is the child support system. Right now, that system is dedicated to collecting as much money from the fathers as possible to support the families. That's all well and good. We somehow have to shift that system towards worrying about the employment of the fathers as well. We have to make that system responsible for getting the fathers working. And that's just as important, maybe more important, as getting them to pay child support. There had been some past experiments to try to do this, programs that basically said to the fathers who were in arrears, you've got to pay up, or you've got to participate in this program, or you're going to prison. And when we did that, we found we could increase the child support payments. What we also have to do is increase the employment. We haven't found a way to do that yet. I think we can probably improve on those programs. The other issue is arrearages. A lot of these men build up substantial debts to the child support system such that they're sort of crushed and they can't work on the books or their wages are going to be attached. We have to make some trade-off here where in return for paying down the debt, these men work consistently for a period of time. So we have some trade-off, some balance between a work obligation and paying every penny that they owe, because employment is probably more important than paying every penny. Now, the second major system is criminal justice. Right now, this system is dedicated to locking up offenders, protecting society. Again, we have to shift the goals towards worrying about employment of people once they leave prison, because as others have said, whether they get a job is crucial to avoiding recidivism. What we have to do is have the system become accountable for the employment outcomes of people leaving prisons. There are a number of prison reentry programs. We're going to hear about them later. Some involve job placement. Some involve mandatory work in community service positions. Those are both worth talking about. The programs that we'll hear about are also being evaluated. That's very important. Programs like this, where we require people to work in return for support, is exactly the sort of thing that might generate positive results for these men and then get public support on a wide scale. And the ultimate problem isn't really money. The real problem is changing the institutions so that employment is built into the mission, not with a special program now, but the core institution. What happened in welfare reform is not that we had a separate program. That's how it started. But then we built employment into the welfare structure. So that became a central goal of the entire system. That's what we have to do with employment for men through child support and criminal justice. And when we do that, I think then we will finally see how these men are channeled towards employment, and they are required to work, but also supported to work, and the goal is integration. The goal is not to blame or exclude or find fault. The goal is to satisfy what I call the common obligations, in this case, employment, and by that means, allow these men to enter into society.
Hi, well, I'm delighted to be here at staring at such a full audience, and I'm sure an audience with lots to say. And I'm only sorry that we're obviously a little squeezed for time here, but important topic, obviously. I do think, however, before going any further, that it's important to remind ourselves that not all black men live in poverty, live in inner city neighborhoods. A third of black families now live in suburbia, a half by self-identification are middle class. And so we're talking here about a sector of the black male community. It is, nevertheless, the problem obviously has a impact on American society in general. It ripples through the fabric of the society, and we ignore it at our peril. I'm going to focus on one aspect of the question. I have lots to say on other aspects, but I'm going to focus on one aspect, and that's education. I found Ronald Mincy's suggestion that we need to try to shape the education, the school day in different ways, giving black boys more recreational time and so forth, a very interesting suggestion. It's one I'm sympathetic to, but I want to make a slightly different point. And let me start by telling you a story. I love the North Star Academy Charter School in Newark, New Jersey. It's hard to find schools that you really, you walk into and you just adore, and that's one of them. And it started out as a middle school, and then it added a high school to it. And one of the conditions of going to the high school is that you have, in fact, attended the middle school. And the middle school is pretty gender balanced. And I was there, the last time I was there, they had just started the high school, and they were doing it one grade at a time. And I walked into the ninth grade, the new ninth grade, and I looked around the room, because the middle school is kind of is gender balanced. I looked around the room, and I said, where are the boys? Because they had disappeared. And I called yesterday the school, because this is a couple of years ago now, and I called the school yesterday and I said, so what's happened? And I didn't get somebody enormously knowledgeable who I called very late in the day, but the person I did get, I said, well, how large is the high school now? It's a complete high school by now. And she said, it's 123 students. And I said, how many of them male? And she said, I don't know. I said, take a guess. She said, well, maybe 50 are male. So what I saw several years ago remains the case. The boys have gone. And nobody at North Star thinks these young men have dropped out of school, but they will not go along with the personal discipline that North Star demands. One of Larry Mead's central points is that investing more in giving young black men education and training would achieve relatively little, because their problem is not a lack of specific job skills. It is more often precisely that lack of personal discipline that North Star and other excellent schools insist upon, and that Steve, my husband, and I discuss at some length in our book, No Excuses, in a chapter called Not by Math Alone. In writing No Excuses, we did think about looking at the gender split, but in the, when one writes a book, one always gives up certain topics, and in the interest of getting the book done, that was one of the topics we didn't look at. But I've just looked at the National Assessment for Educational Progress, the nation's report card on education. I've just looked at the NAEP 12th grade scores, and they're quite fascinating. They suggest that the huge gender imbalance in college enrollments, you got two females for every male when you're talking about college enrollments, is not an indication that black adolescent males lag far behind black women in cognitive skills, because they don't. Blacks in general lag behind whites and Asians, but the gender gap for blacks is not sufficiently striking to account for that total imbalance in college enrollment. Take math. There is no statistically significant gender difference among black students in math. No statistically significant gender difference. In reading, it's true that black 12th grade males are almost a grade level behind their sisters, their black sisters in high school. But we should note that the gender gap among African Americans is only half as large as it is among whites. White males, on the average, are close to 2 years behind their white classmates, their white female classmates in reading, in contrast to 1 year for black males versus black females. Perhaps, however, there's an obvious explanation. Results are somewhat deceptive, because black males are more likely to drop out of high school and therefore in 12th grade aren't available for the test. But, and you know, that would make them obviously a more selective population. Perhaps, but two things. One, there is no consensus at present on how to count the dropout rate. There's the J. Green camp, I'll call it, pitted against what I'll call the Stephen Thernstrom camp, which, and my husband relies on the current, on the U.S. Census data, and looks at percentages of whites and blacks who have actually graduated from high school by, I think it's age 25, and very little difference. But without wading into that battle, I would suggest that neither method yields such large gender differences in dropout rates for blacks, obviously, as to account for the rough parity of boys and girls on the NAEP scores, in math most strikingly, but in reading as well, compared to whites. So back to Larry Mead's point for a minute. Schools like North Star and the KIPP Academies and other really successful, they're all charter schools, they're all out from under the regular public system. They understand something fundamental. Their inner city children need an education way beyond reading, writing, and arithmetic. They need an education in a much broader set of skills. These schools focus relentlessly, it's true, on core academic subjects. They provide also a safe and orderly environment in which kids can learn, but they also aim to shape the culture of their students as that culture affects academic learning, as that culture affects the acquisition of skills and knowledge that will mean they'll end up with good jobs in life. Orlando Patterson has written, "The greatest problem now facing African Americans is their isolation from the tacit norms of the dominant culture." And superb schools uniformly attack that isolation of black kids from mainstream norms by making certain demands. And the isolation, of course, seems to be worse among black males than black females. These schools insist their students learn how to speak standard English, show up on time, properly dress, sit up straight in their desk, chairs pulled in, workbooks organized. They're never allowed to waste a minute in which they could be learning. They walk down halls quickly and quietly. They always finish their homework. They look at people when they're talking to them. They listen to teachers politely. They follow their directions precisely. They treat their classmates with equal respect. They shake hands with visitors to the school, introducing themselves. Even minor infractions of the rules, shirt not tucked in, some foul language, have immediate consequences. In other words, as journalist David Shipler has put the point, the soft skills of punctuality, diligence, and a can-do attitude, that is, internalized self-discipline and a belief that it will matter, it will pay off, are as important as basic math, and these skills know it. Other equally important messages permeate the culture of these schools. They deliver an optimistic message about America and about the rules that govern climbing the ladder of economic opportunity in this country. The message is the doors are open for those who make the right decisions. Opportunities outweigh barriers. Determination pays off. The effort to put disadvantaged youths on the traditional ladder of social mobility has another related component. It's never explicitly articulated. The best inner city schools and students define themselves as individuals. Ralph Ellison in the 1970s wrote the following: "If white society has tried to do anything to us, it has tried to keep us from being individuals. To deprive blacks of the understanding that individuality is still operative beyond the racial structuring of America." These schools want their students to think of themselves as individuals beyond the racial structuring of America, free to emphasize their racial and ethnic group ties as much or as little as they wish. That is a very tall order in contemporary America. Contemporary America delivers, in general, such a different message, a message that race is who you are. And race-related public policies reinforce that view. Racial preferences in higher education and contracting and employment, racially gerrymandered voting districts, elementary and secondary school systems that assign pupils to school on the basis of the color of their skin. Omaha, Nebraska is in the middle of trying to do so. by splitting the district into three racially identifiable subdistricts. All such policies say the same thing. Race or ethnicity is the single most important fact about you as an individual. And from there, it's a straight line to the belief on the part of blacks themselves that whites are powerful, blacks are helpless, and to the profound alienation from mainstream American society that's so pernicious and that we have to address. Thank you very much.
We're going to take 10 minutes for questions. We're going to take 10 minutes for questions and first hands, and then wait until you get the microphone before you ask your question. We'll start with this gentleman here in the front, sir, right here.
My name is Nelson Farmer, and I'm a very well-exposed person in other parts of the country. Now, I think the first problem in what you all are getting at, and it's not in the form of a question, is that black history needs to be taught in schools because the kids do not have black pride. Somebody designed some baggy pants and baggy...
The most important thing, and we want to hear what you have to say, but with 10 sequences of 60 seconds, we want to get in more than one person. So please just ask a question. And then
ask a question?
Yeah, ask a question.
I don't have a question.
This gentleman in the back?
Excuse me.
Back here.
John, good to see you on the right coast and not the left coast. quick question, and this is a generic one that all of you, including John, can answer. On research, it just seems to me that as America becomes urbanized, the schools of education have these urban education formats and programs. There's a growing disconnect between the theorists, the researchers, et cetera, and the participants, which are largely black and Latino, from which all of these conclusions are drawn. That translates to me into governance structure, particularly in the New York school system, where there are 250 research studies on an increasingly brown and black population from which we conclude these things. My question is how can we close the gap, if you will, between researchers, theorists, governance, and the people who are governed and are the research participants?
Well, it's a very good question. I mean, my first answer, I have to tell you, is close the education schools down. There's more garbage coming out of those schools than, you know, I can cope with. There are so few voices doing good, so few scholars doing good work on education. And I think, interestingly enough, most of them are economists, and they are not in ed schools. People like Carolyn Hoxby at Harvard, economist, not in an ed school, and so forth. Some of them are at think tanks. But, you know, I got to say a second sentence that's only tangentially related to what you have to say. After you burn the education, close all the education schools down, burn the public school system down as well. At a recent meeting to celebrate departing Boston Superintendent Tom Paysant, his second in command said something very courageous, and my jaw dropped because this guy has been a bureaucrat for the whole time, for the last 10 years in Boston. He said, "These large urban systems cannot be turned around within the current structure of public education." And you know, an outgoing guy could say that. If I said it, which I often do, nobody listens, but people might listen to him, and it's the truth.
Is there a way to turn this on?
I
I never understand.
Yeah. Okay.
This gentleman right here?
As researchers, and I guess in general, we use the term African-American and black as though it's interchangeable. Who are we talking about? Is it important that we disaggregate cultural experiences of black folk to understand that, as you point out, not all black folk have the problem? And if we were to disaggregate it today, who are we talking about? African-Americans, Haitians, Jamaicans?
I would like to suggest that I think the point that you're getting at dissipates across generations. So if we were talking about the Jamaicans with whom I went to school, they would possess a culture about education and work closer to the ideology of their parents who were immigrants, and you would see radical differences between the outcomes of them and native-born and African-Americans. On the other hand, two or three generations later, we begin to see, for example, and I think this is troubling, and there's a local context. First of all, 70% of the students in the University of the West Indies are women. In the United States, I was very curious about your comments, because though we don't see big differences in the cognitive abilities, the measured abilities between black girls and black boys, today, on HBCUs, 70% of the students are also women. And increasingly, in non-HBCUs, the proportion of African American, so they may not be showing up differently in terms of their scores, but they are radically different in terms of who gets in and who gets through.
Oh, but
so
I said that.
I didn't hear it.
Well,
I was trying to answer the gentleman's question. So I think, again, to your point, as we work through cohorts, I think the differences in the outcomes for Jamaicans, the differences in the outcomes for even African students who are now in the United States, are beginning to show that gender and color is beginning to disadvantage ethnic groups of color in ways that we would only recognize are relevant to African Americans years ago.
You know, we don't have the data, however, to track these students. I mean, NAEP, the National System for Educational Progress.
If you look at a study that is being done by Doug Massey on enrollment rates of black students in historically black and colleges generally, it clearly shows that African American male students are declining in their enrollments relative to girls.
No, I'm talking about the Haitians versus the American borns.
He does this across by color and ethnicity.
Yeah, but look
at
the foreign born. I do know it. The foreign born are a relatively small group. Unfortunately, we do not track them. One of the things NAEP should do is ask for the country of origin of your parents. It doesn't ask that simple question. The states, which are collecting enormous amounts of data on students, have the capacity to answer the question of what happens to foreign students, foreign-born students, the Haitians, the Jamaicans, etc. They don't ask the questions. It's very important, but we don't have the data. That was the only point. That was the point I was stressing myself.
Thank you, Abby. One more question. This lady right here in the base.
I want to ask a question in relevance to what he just said. Do you think that America is playing African Americans and the West Indians against each other? And I say that only because in the old days, when I remember, it was that the West Indians were getting the jobs and the African Americans weren't, but they were being hired. And like you just said, that as the next generation, as they come in, they become African American. And now they're using the Latino. I mean, I'm not... You know, they're using the Latino now. The West Indians can't get the work. The Latinos are. So now they're the ones that want the jobs, and they're good people because they want the jobs. But I think that I want to ask you that question. Do you think that anyone that comes to this country will get work before the African American? And that way, it keeps everybody divided. That's my question.
I don't think there's a deliberate policy. It comes to seem that way because the group we're talking about primarily here, which is low-income men, who are black mostly, but they could also include other groups, they simply are less employable. We have to recognize that there are real issues of employability
And so the new groups, in this case, it's the aliens coming in from Mexico, they get the jobs. There's no policy. That simply is in the interest of the employers. We have to recognize our problem is to increase the employability of the native-born. I personally think we need to worry about that. We also have to restrain immigration, but there's no policy.
Yeah. Let me say one sentence on that, too. Hillard Pouncey has data that fascinated me. He said, look, 38% of young jobless black men are out of the labor force entirely, admit to earnings from crime. But he then says that employers don't want to hire young black men out of fear of crime. But his own chart shows that 30% of those who do have jobs are nevertheless involved in crime. So, you know, maybe employers are reacting to something that is legitimate.
With that, we're going to close this panel. We're going to have a brief break, and then we'll begin the second panel. Thank you very much.